Welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about the craft of writing and being an indie in the world of self-publishing. Each week, we'll read a chapter from an unpublished novel and critique it. To read along with the show, go to indieauthoranswers.com. To follow along from chapter one, go to jimheskett.com/part1. Or to get a recap of the first half of the story, go to jimheskett.com/recap. Now, let's get this mother started. So here's your host, Jim Heskett.
Yo, welcome to Indie Author Answers episode number 59. That's 59. That's one short of 60. I'm going to try to talk fast and cut the chitty chat because we have a very long section of book to read today. I would encourage you to go to indieauthoranswers.com and read along with it if you're listening to the week it comes out. If not, you can go dig through the archives to find the text at jimheskett.com where I keep my blog and all the text is there. So I know I got to break a promise to you guys. I know I said we were going to do Elmore Leonard's Rules 6 through 10 or 7 through 10 this week, but because of the fact that we have such a long section to read, I'm only going to read Rule 7 and 8. I know. I'm sorry. I wasn't going to do any, but then I thought, no, I can't do that. I can't put off the rules for a whole week. That would be cruel. So we're just going to do two of them, and then we'll do the last two next week. Okay? Is that cool? You guys, do you forgive me? Do you still love me? Okay, good. I thought so. And so here we go. Number 7. Use regional dialect, patois, sparingly. Number 8, avoid detailed descriptions of characters. So here I think we're getting into a little more specific things. I know the things before that he said have been specific, like, you know, avoid prologues. But I think those are had a lot of spirit in those things. And these things get into a little more descriptive examples. Like using regional dialect, the patois sparingly. I think a great example, if you're an author, you should go read Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell. It's one of my favorite books, and I think it's a book written specifically for authors, I think, because what he does in that book, and I'm sure I've talked about this before, and I wrote a review of both the book and the movie on my blog, but what I love about this book is that it's six separate stories told in two halves. Each story gets broken up. It's like the first half of six stories, then the second half of those same six stories. And each of those stories is in a different genre. And I want to talk about one of them specifically that takes place far, far in the future, in a dystopian future, after the fall of civilization. And I think it's in Hawaii. I'm not sure. I think that's where it was in the movie, or it's not quite clear. But anyway, these people in this story have their own language that's close to English, but is basically a very, very deep dialect of English. And in the movie, it came across as cheesy. I mean, even though it was Tom Hanks saying the dialogue, it still came out as cheesy. But in the book, it's really effective, and he uses this dialect that's full of slang and words with apostrophes in strange places. And the thing is, in the book, it is really, really hard to read. Like, you have to really, the learning curve is super steep. And I think that's partly proving Elmore Leonard's point that if you have a regional dialogue, what you're doing is you're adding a level of complexity to your story, that you're adding things that you're demanding of your readers for them to be able to appreciate the story. You know, like using words like ain't, that's fine because it's so people are so used to that kind of thing. Ain't is a good word for a Southern person to use, or y'all, or for East Coast use, or if you're writing a story in Philadelphia, you-ins. These kind of things are good, and when they're used sparingly, they're a great way to establish character. By the way, I mean, I think a lot of Elmore Leonard's rules are pointing specifically to say differentiate dialogue by the way that people talk, particularly the next one, number 8, that we're going to get into. So if you pepper a person's speech very lightly with words like Ewan's, it helps to establish character. If you do it too much, then it can make it really complex. Like one of the things that I did in, I'll give you two examples. My novel Reagan's Ashes, I included an Australian character, and I wrote some scenes from the book in his POV, and I wanted it to be very, very authentic. Like, I don't know if you've been to Australia, or maybe if you're listening to this, and you're in Australia right now, let me say, hello, how are you going? So I wanted it to be, I used to live in Australia, so I am pretty steeped in Australian slang. So I wanted it to be as authentic as possible. But the problem I ran into was that I kept, I wrote books with a lot of slang, like I talked about words like Grundies instead of underwear, that kind of thing. But then when I gave the book to beta readers, often they were lost. You know, they were like, so there are all these words and I don't know what they mean. And so it kind of took me out of the story. So I had to tone that down quite a bit. And so I think that in the book that I'm just finishing up right now, Sallow City, which is the newest book in the Micah Reed series, the book takes place in Michigan. And I've never lived in Michigan, but my wife is from there. So I've been to Michigan a lot. And so I wanted to include a lot of that kind of Michigan culture. And a word that people, probably only people in Michigan know is Youper. You know, Michigan is a state that's divided into two halves, the Upper Peninsula and Lower Peninsula, and people who live in the Upper Peninsula are called Youpers. So I wanted to talk, and if you're in Michigan, you know the word Youper pretty well. It's part of everyday language. So I wanted to include the word Youper, but I also wanted to make it clear what it means. For people who live outside of Michigan. And the bad way to do this would have been like, oh, that guy's a Youper, and have another character say, oh, when you say that, do you mean that he lives above the Mackinac Bridge? Or the Mackinac Bridge, I'm sorry. That would have been a bad way to do it. Instead, what I did was I had characters talk about Youpers, and then in a scene later, I had a character who wasn't from Michigan ask a character from Michigan, hey, people who live above the bridge are called Youpers. Does that mean people who live below the bridge are called Lopers? You know, just kind of, and in that scene, the character who's asking the question serves the position of being the reader who doesn't know. And I think it actually came up pretty well. I was pleased with it because it's just kind of natural dialogue. It's exposition, but I tried to write the dialogue very natural sounding. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking about that because I'm wasting time here. And like I said, we have a long reading to get through. I'm making it sound like a chore. I don't mean to do that. It's going to be exciting. We have a couple of good chapters to read. Number 8, avoid detailed descriptions of characters. Now, this one I like a lot. I very rarely will write in physical descriptions of my characters. And not just Elmore Leonard believes in this rule. This is one of the things that Stephen King talked about in writing. He was like, don't describe how characters look, particularly don't describe what they're wearing. And I agree with that to an extent about what they look like and what they're wearing. Here's when I will give a physical description of a character. If they appear only a small amount in the book. Like if you want to, I think if your main characters, your POV characters, your major character in the story, don't tell us what they look like. Let us get a sense of who that person is through what they say and what they do. But if it's a minor character who appears in only a handful of scenes, I think it's entirely reasonable to give the reader a sense of who that character is by describing them. And so I've been dinged in my reviews by people who like extensive descriptions of characters. They're like, he never really said what Reagan looked like in Reagan's Ashes. That's some reviews that I've got. And that's a valid point. But I don't want you, I think the only thing I actually ever said about Reagan in that book is that she was a brunette. And I don't think, you know, that came probably from somebody else's POV. When I read books, I don't really picture what characters look like. They're all just kind of faceless to me. So I don't feel like describing the curve of someone's eyebrows or the color of their eyes. That kind of thing, I don't really think that's important. Because I think you as the reader should determine how characters look to you. But I think the spirit of Elmore Leonard's rule here, to avoid detailed descriptions of characters, is that, one, a detailed description of character can be boring. Two, it's probably not necessary if you're showing us who that character is through what he or she says and does. And so that's the spirit of his rule there. All right, I'm going to stop talking about that, and we're going to move on to the reading portion of the show. Today we're going to read two chapters, and it's two chapters because one of them is very short, and then one of them is kind of longish, and I didn't want to split them up separately. The first is a Brian chapter, and then there's an Alex chapter. And so the last time we saw Brian, he was at Heather, his ex-girlfriend Heather's funeral, and he was devastated. He told Wiles he didn't want to sell drugs anymore. He told Megan he didn't want to have anything to do with her. And also the last time we saw Alex, he was getting pushed up against a wall in Wiles' house because he had finally told Wiles about seeing Brian kiss Megan. All right then? All right, here we go. Part 4, Chapter 9, Brian. Brian drove up Highway 36 towards Boulder after the service, his tie loosened, the top button of his shirt unbuttoned. His sport coat hung over the headrest of the passenger seat of his Honda. No music played on his stereo, as he instead opted for silence during his drive. He ran his finger up and down the length of his tie, feeling its silky smoothness. Brian removed his phone from his pocket, opened his list of contacts, and then scrolled through them, alternately glancing between the road and his phone as he did so. When he reached the contact for Robson Heather, he hesitated. He pressed the delete key, then again to confirm. He tossed the phone onto the passenger seat. When he reached Boulder, he did not feel like going home. He had an urge to drink or get high to neutralize his emotions. But after spending a week as a drunken shut-in in his apartment, he wanted to find a better way. Instead of opting for a drink or a smoke, he decided to listen to the grumble in his stomach and get his favorite sandwich from Half Fast Subs on the hill. He stopped at a drugstore and bought a package of nicotine gum before heading to the deli. He waited in line in his slacks, dress shirt, and loosened tie and ordered his sandwich to go. When he exited Half Fast, a couple police officers were standing on the side of the street. Out of habit, Brian gave them a wide berth while walking towards his car. Brian? The sound originated from the direction of the cops, and sure enough, Brian recognized one of them. The familiar voice came from Brent Gardner, the RA in Brian Storm when he'd been a freshman. Brent had been kind to Brian while he navigated the new experience of college. He helped Brian get to class, told him which of the campus cafeterias and fraternity parties to avoid, among other things. Except Brent never showed me how to make a weed pipe out of an apple. Brian walked toward Brent, taking in his old friend's new look. Brian found it hard to believe that he was seeing the same guy, because the formerly chubby man now looked fit, with an aura of confidence about him and a rigidly upright posture. Brent Gardner, is that you?
Yes, sir. Long time no see. You're all dressed up, though. Just getting off work?
Oh, I had a thing down in Denver, Brian said. Seems like I run into somebody I know every other day now. But look at you, all in uniform and everything.
Brent showered Brian with the mile-wide, lost-long friend smile, but Brian had trouble reciprocating. Not a good day to smile.
Damn straight, Brent said. All I ever wanted to be was a cop, and now here I am.
So here you are. I'm glad to see you're still kicking around Boulder, too. Hard to leave this town once you've fallen in love with it.
No doubt. Whatever that guy said about seeing the Flatirons and not being able to leave, Chief Niwot's curse, Brent said.
Yeah, that's it. I think it worked. I'm probably stuck here for life, too.
There's worse places to be, Brent said. After the academy, I spent some time down in New Orleans. Everybody thinks of it as this dirty place, as just some place they go for fun for a little while, and then they go back to their normal lives. But the crime down there is outrageous. All the murders, rapes, and car thefts, just to name a few. It's an incredibly dangerous city.
Is that right? Brian said.
Oh, absolutely. Not anything like Colorado. We're pretty lucky to live in such a normal place, especially Boulder, where that kind of stuff almost never happens. Brian and Brent exchanged phone numbers and made some vague plans about getting coffee, about which Brian assumed Brent was just being polite. Given the hobbies of Brian and the people around him, befriending a cop would not be the smartest of ideas.
10. Alex.
After revealing what he knew about Brian and Megan, Wiles gave Alex leave to go home and shower. He arrived to find the apartment empty, a relief to Alex because he could not bear anyone seeing him in this state.
His hands quivered, not just from the lack of sleep or the days-long methamphetamine binge, but also from his growing sense of dread. More punishment from Wiles might be coming. After his shower, he checked his phone, and a text from Wiles invited Alex to have coffee at Buchanan's. He loathed coffee and the entire coffee-drinking subculture, but could not refuse Wiles, so he texted him that he would join him soon. At the coffee shop, Alex ordered some sugary espresso drink just because of its colorful name. After joining Wiles at their table, Alex tried not to stare at the bruises on the knuckles of Wiles' right hand. Alex knew better than to ask how that had happened. He and Wiles sat at a table facing the street, and Alex people-watched as Wiles told Alex a story about a guy he knew in Utah, the meaning of which escaped Alex. Alex became increasingly uneasy because, at the end of each story beat, Wiles paused and scrutinized Alex to see if he had absorbed the information. Alex did his best to make eye contact and appear pensive. Alex watched two young men, dressed in white shirts and black ties and carrying Bibles, as they walked up the hill. He decided to change the subject. "I was reading about the Bilderberg Group the other day. You know the mayor of Denver's a member, right?" "I've no idea what you're talking about." "The Illuminati, the Masons, the guys who actually run everything. It all ties back to the Bilderberg Group. They're the ones who set the oil prices, the ones running the World Bank, NATO, the UN, all that shit." "I don't understand what that has to do with anything." Wiles sounded uninterested, but Alex carried on. "It has everything to do with everything. The New World Order? They're going to destroy the middle class and make us all their servants. 10 years from now, everyone will know who they are and what their plan is. I don't understand why everyone isn't talking about it. This is real shit." Wiles leaned to Alex and in a measured voice said, "You need to settle the fuck down. Nobody gonna make us servants. All your conspiracy theory bullshit is making you crazy in the head." Had it been anyone else, Alex might have launched into his prepared speech about all the alleged conspiracy theorists throughout history that have been proven right. But with he and Wiles sharing such unsteady ground today, Alex thought it best to keep his mouth shut. Out of the corner of his eye, Alex spotted a familiar mop of red hair and excused himself from the table. He approached the redhead and he glided along the wall next to her. "Hey, Jessica," he said to the girl from his party in January. "Jennifer," she said, while showing him a courteous smile. "Alex, right?" "Yep, that's me. I didn't hear back from you after that night. I thought we were going to..." He trailed off, letting her fill in the blank. Jennifer the redhead studied him, her eyes focusing on his face and lack of hair. "You look different," she said. Since that night, Alex had dropped about 15 pounds, had added some dark circles under his eyes, and now opted for the full-on shaved head look. Alex pressed on with the suave routine. "Oh, right, yep, I got my eyebrows plucked. No excuse for not looking your best with the state of the world today." Jennifer said nothing. An uncomfortable bit of dead air followed, so Alex decided to cut his losses. "All right then, well, I guess I'll see you around," he said. She persisted with a polite smile, but said nothing further. What in the hell? 3 months ago, this chick was dying to let me in her panties, drinking up pot milkshakes in my kitchen. Alex returned to Wiles, who stared, transfixed, out the window. "Nice tits," he said, without looking at Alex. Wiles tapped on the glass, and when Alex focused his eyes and comprehended the scene across the street, he did a double take. Brian, dressed like a corporate chimpanzee in a shirt and tie, was talking to a police officer right where anyone could see them. A goddamn police officer. What in the fuck is going on? Why is Brian talking to a cop? Wiles sucked on his teeth and then drained the last bit of his coffee. "I don't know," he said, "but it's time for us to get out of here." That night, Alex and Wiles drove north of Boulder to a farm to play Alex's paintball and cows game. The rules of the game? Alex shoots cows and they both laugh about it. Never seem to get old. Wiles parked his Jeep near the property fence and they both sat on the still warm hood. Alex readied his marker as Wiles rolled a joint. Wiles pointed at a cow. "That one," he said, and Alex found it in its sights and then squeezed the trigger. A direct hit, the cow jumped, a loud moo, and the humans laughed. Alex took a cigarette from his pack and lit the wrong end. Cursing, he again made the same mistake with another. "Son of a bitch," he said as he threw his pack on the ground. He rested his head on the barrel of his marker, warm from the recent shots. His jaw hurt after hours of grinding his teeth. He wished his body would slow down so he could feel tired. but he had an abundance of mental energy. Thoughts bounced like racquetballs against the court of his brain. "Your roommate sent me this today," Weil said, handing his phone to Alex. Alex read it, then gave the phone back. "Do you think it has something to do with seeing that cop?" he said. "Maybe. He sent me the text before that. I don't know yet what the thing with the cop was. I've been way too lenient with Connolly, and I can see that now. It's not going to happen anymore." Alex struggled to frame the series of events in perspective, a multitude of racquetballs bouncing too quickly to catch them all. Brian slept with Wiles' sister-in-law. He quit selling weed, and then he met a cop on the hill. What does it all mean? Is he going to sell us out? "I can't believe the balls of this guy. He's going to disrespect me like that and then just bounce out," Wiles said. Alex took aim at another cow and pulled the trigger. The shots missed but startled the creature enough that it trotted away. Moo. A few more cows scurried away with it. "Like he just drop off my radar," Wiles continued, "with no harm done?" The more Alex thought about it, the more everything now pointed to Brian doing something with the cops. Alex had been out of town for almost a week, and he had no idea what Brian did during that time. Maybe the cops picked him up for DUI or something and he had to give up Wiles as part of a deal. If that's the case, then I would be implicated. Would Wiles protect me, or would he roll over on me too? "Something has to be done," Alex said. Unsure what exactly, but he believed that whatever Brian was planning needed to stop. Brian needed to be stopped. Wiles hopped off the hood of the car and proceeded to wipe some grime from the headlights of the Jeep with his sleeve. "I've got an idea," he said. "I need you with me on this. I need you to trust me. This might get kind of messy." Wiles' comment barely registered with Alex because he had become embroiled in a staring contest with the most dastardly cow he had ever laid eyes upon. Black eyes, patchy brown fur. The mangy creature's persistent look dared him to shoot. Across the blackness of the night, their four eyes met somewhere in the middle, and Alex became of a singular intention. Alex honed his focus and readied himself for mayhem. "Pull the trigger, human. You'll never hit me." "Whatever," Alex said. "Hang on, let me tag this one cocksmoker who keeps staring at me." Alex raised the marker and lined up a putrid beast in his sights. Wiles slapped the hood of the car, breaking Alex's concentration. "Damn it, Britton, stop. Look at me right now." Wiles' tone shocked Alex back into the real world. Only a few hours ago, this man's fingers had been laced around Alex's neck, squeezing the life out of him. "Are you in?" "Yeah, dude, I told you, whatever," Alex said as lip service, because all he cared about was this menacing cow. Staring him down like a fighter in the opposite corner of the ring, the cow moved its head back and forth. The eyes radiated piercing blackness, and jets of steamy breath escaped the beast's nose into the cold night air. "Fuck you, human." Alex raised his paint gun and spit several shots toward the cow. Some missed right, but one tagged the cow dead center in the eye. The beast squealed and then fell over. Alex raised the paintball marker to the sky, triumphant. "Who's staring now, eh?" "Aw, goddammit, not in the head. You probably killed it, you tweaked out bastard." Wiles glared at him, pulling Alex back into the real world. The last thing in the world he wanted right now was to piss off Derek Wiles. And all right, that's our reading. I gotta say, the thing with the tense part with the cow at the end, I like that. Because it's one of those things that's like, it's kind of funny, and it's also kind of sad, because it really demonstrates Alex's deteriorating state of mind, that he is engaged in this psychological war with a cow, and he anthropomorphizes the cow, you know, I think that's the right word, right? Personification, anthropomorphification of the cow. Anyway, so let's go back to this Brian chapter. What we have is Brian driving back from Heather's funeral, and I think it's supposed to demonstrate here how wrecked he is. But in this first paragraph, we have a whole lot of unnecessary description. Like, Brian removed his phone from his pocket. Things like that. And I still do a little bit of that in my fiction, but I do it a little more intentionally if I'm trying to describe something mundane. Brian removed his phone from his pocket, opened his list of contacts, and then he scrolled through them, alternately glancing between the road and his phone as he did so. There's a whole lot of description there that doesn't really need to be. You could just say, like, Brian took out his phone and scrolled through his list of contacts. and it would be half the words and get the same point across. But the thing of here is that Brian is deleting Heather's contact out of his phone, and this is supposed to be cathartic. It's supposed to show Brian putting his past behind him. At least that's the subtext. That's the intention that I'm trying to get across there. And then we have a bit of plot engineering, because what we need is we need to get Brian in a place where he can be talking with a cop where coincidentally Wiles and Alex can see him doing it. So he doesn't feel like going home. He wants to go get a sub. So he goes to the hill, and we already established way early on in the book that Wiles likes to drink coffee at Buchanan's. It's one of those things like in, you know, in Wayne's World, which is, if you're young, it's a movie that probably came out before you were born. In Wayne's World, when he gets that information about where the record producer is going to be, and then later on he's like, we know that he's going to be here. Huh, that information seemed extraneous at the time. You know, which is kind of a fourth wall thing, but like, it may have seemed extraneous at the time, way back when we learned that Wiles likes to drink coffee at Buchanan's, but now we know why it says that. So anyway, Brian buys some nicotine gum, which is further demonstrating his commitment to change, and he goes into Half Fast Subs. He comes out, and he sees this cop that he used to know. And then we have a long dialogue section that, you know, something like 300, 400 words, you know, with like a page and a half of paperback text that doesn't really accomplish anything. My intention was to demonstrate that this guy used to be Brian's mentor and now he's a cop. And so it's meant for Brian to reflect on what a poor mentor he was for Alex. But instead, they're just talking about blah-bitty-blah, Brent Gardner, that's you, getting off work, oh, I had a thing. And then they're talking about crime in New Orleans, and it doesn't really have anything to do with anything, except there's one part in here that's kind of interesting, where Brian says, I'm glad to see you're still kicking around Boulder and hard to leave this town. And then Brian says, I'm probably stuck here for life too. And this is so strange because it seemed like not too long ago, Brian was thinking, at least, I don't know if he said it to anyone, but he was thinking at least that one of his main goals was to get out of Colorado, and he was even saving money for it. So this is like a plot hole here. It's like, if Brian is just paying lip service to this guy Brent, which, you know, those are two B names, which I should have thought about that. If Brian's just paying lip service here to him, and one of his goals is still to get out of town, then there should have been some kind of internal monologue for Brian to reflect on that fact, or at least feel guilty for lying to this dude, or something like that. Because this here just seems like a conflict with what Brian's stated goal has already been. You know what I'm saying? Right. So Brian just chitty chats with this guy, and if you're reading this, you may be thinking, I don't understand what this has to do with anything. Or you may be thinking, you know, he's probably going to be, if a really astute reader would probably be like, he's going to be seen. Somebody's going to see him doing this. And then we move on to chapter 10, Alex, and there are two separate scenes here. There's actually a few scenes. There's three scenes here, but there's a scene break and two literal scenes here. So the first scene is Alex goes home to take a shower after what happened with Wiles and Alex. One thing that's interesting to note is that we still don't know what happened with Wiles and Megan. If you remember the last 2 weeks, those chapters ended on cliffhangers with Wiles pounding on Megan's door after he had learned that she had at least kissed Brian and slept with him. And so we don't know what happened with that. And we don't learn what happened with that in this chapter. So that's a little frustrating. It's something that I do see in fiction all the time, you know, delaying gratification. And up to a point it works. If we were to go for four or five more chapters before finding out what happened to Megan, that would be seriously frustrating. So the only little clue we get, it's not even a clue, but the only kind of information we get related to that previous cliffhanger is that this is after he revealed, Wiles gave him leave to go home and shower. So we don't know anything.
Alex comes home. The apartment's empty. And he takes a shower. Then he checks his phone. So he still hasn't slept. And there's a reference to his days-long methamphetamine binge. He still hasn't slept. And Alex tells him to go meet him for coffee. So this is all setting up, you know, what's going to happen, that they're going to see Brian talking to this cop. So Alex isn't into coffee, and this is something we didn't know about him before. But he goes there and he orders a drink because he feels, you know, indebted to Wilds, even though I'm telling you this, but it doesn't really show it here about how worried Alex is, you know, that he's still... It does say in here something about more punishment from Wilds might be coming soon, but it's not really very clearly... we don't really see Alex worrying about it all that much. There's a couple of references in this chapter to it, but I think Alex would be a lot more freaked out. You know, I mean, he might think that Wilds still could put a bullet in him. And then we also don't know if Alex is thinking that Wilds could put a bullet in him. Why is he still going to have coffee with him? Why wouldn't Alex pack up his shit and get the hell out of there? That's not really explained very well. And as a reader, that's what I would be thinking. Well, you know, this, you maybe have some kind of loyalty to this guy, but he could definitely kill you. Why are you still hanging out with him? So Alex's loyalty to Wilds isn't very clearly understood. At least I know, as a reader, I don't really understand why Wilds has such deep loyalty to Alex after all this happened. So then, you might not have even noticed this because it's such a fleeting reference, but there's a bit of either a clue or a red herring, maybe, when they get there, and Wilds tells Alex a story about a guy he knew in Utah. And if you remember, that's where Brian at least thinks that Jimmy, his little brother, went to. But we know that Wilds knows something about Jimmy that no one else knows, because he mentioned that to Alex, and Alex doesn't know the meaning of it. But here we have Wilds talking about Utah, and this is such a tiny, fleeting little hint. It's probably lost on people, but it's intended just maybe for really astute people to see it. It probably doesn't work. It's too quick, and it doesn't really accomplish anything. Then Alex goes on this rant, this conspiracy theorist rant about the Bilderberg Group, and you can kind of tell based on what it is here that I just, like, looked it up on Wikipedia and just, like, probably copied and pasted, probably plagiarized some stuff from Wikipedia, put it on here. But if you remember, Alex is a conspiracy theorist for no real good reason. It doesn't really it's meant to inform his character, but it doesn't really. Because while Alex may talk about conspiracy theories, he doesn't really behave like a conspiracy theorist. He doesn't really affect his decisions. It doesn't really affect his motivations. And if you writing a conspiracy theorist could be really fun, it could be a great character if it affected the plot somehow. You know, if you worked it into the plot, it could really affect that. But the fact that Alex is a conspiracy theorist, and I'm sure I've mentioned this before, is basically just a throwaway detail about him. It's basically just something for him to fill up word count, and it doesn't really accomplish anything. Now, there are things like that. Like, you could have a character who plays guitar, and you could mention a couple times in your book that he owned a guitar or he sat plucking a guitar, and that's something that maybe it's a detail that just informs his character and doesn't affect the plot. You don't need to cut that out because you're not taking up a lot of word space. You know, just the fact that a character plays guitar. Is this dumb? Am I talking about something that doesn't really matter here? And I apologize. You just heard a Dropbox notification on my computer. And I'm not going to cut it out because I'm raw. And that's just how this show goes. And you guys know that. Anyway, that was a good chance for me to change the subject. So then we go from this New World Order discussion to Alex spotting a familiar person, a familiar redhead, in the coffee shop. Here's another coincidence. And also, if you remember, I talked before about how I used to like to have, if a character appeared once, they should appear again, even though this one serves a purpose, serves a good purpose. If you don't remember, way back at the beginning of part 3, you know, like 20 chapters ago, when Alex and Brian had a party at their new apartment, Alex was trying to get into the pants of this red-headed girl. And he didn't succeed, but he did succeed in flirting with her and making her interested in him. And then for whatever reason, they didn't talk again, and now they're seeing each other. And the point of this is to demonstrate how much Alex has changed. Now, I do give a little bit of telling here instead, because I didn't trust the reader to understand organically how things would have changed. And I say, since that night, Alex had dropped 15 pounds, had added some dark circles under his eyes, and now opted for the full-on shaved head look. I probably could have gotten those physical descriptions across through dialogue or through other things, through little visual cues, because we're in Alex's POV, and talking about the dark circles under his eyes doesn't really jibe with that kind of POV. But basically, Alex tries to be his same flirty self that he used to be, and it doesn't work. You know, he's talking about getting his eyebrows plucked, and she's like, whatever. There's some dead air, and Alex is like, all right, I'll see you around. And he's like, I don't understand. She was dying to let me get in her panties, and now she won't have anything to do with me. So it's also trying to demonstrate how clueless Alex is about how the drug world has changed him. And then the actual conflict of the scene happens, in that now we understand why Brian was in that place and time, and why he saw the cop and was chatting with him, why that had to happen. You know, the plot-driven reason why all that happened was so that Alex and Wiles could see him doing that. And this is the main benefit of a multi-POV book, is that you can do stuff like this, because now the readers know something that not all of the characters know, because Alex and Wiles now know something about Brian that Brian doesn't know. And if this book had been written in first-person POV from Brian's perspective, we would have missed out on a chance to see this scene. So I'm not to say that first-person POV is bad. In fact, I'm quite a big fan of it for certain purposes. But here is one thing you can do in a multi-POV book that you can't do in a single POV book. So they've seen Brian talking to this cop, and so now we know that something is going to happen with him. Then we have a scene break. And then they go to play Alex's paintball and cows game. And this is something that I just made up, but I really like it. I've never actually done this. I've never gone cow tipping. And you guys know I've never actually played paintball, which is something I've talked about before, which is something I probably should have done in researching the story, was I should at least have held a paintball marker in my hand. But I didn't, because I didn't really think research was important at that time. So they go play this paintballing game, and they're sitting on the hood of Alex's Jeep. And I talked a few weeks ago about adding motion to your stories. And even though they're just sitting on the hood of the car and talking, the fact that they're playing this paintball game, I think it does add some nice motion to this chapter, because it's not just back and forth dialogue. They're actually, something is going on to give the reader a visual, some visual cues about things that are happening. So the first actual plot thing that happens in this chapter is Wilde hands his phone to Alex. And now, if you don't remember what it says, your roommate sent me this today, Wilde said, handing his phone to Alex. And if you don't remember, it was a few chapters ago, Brian, at the funeral, Brian texted Wilde and said, I'm done selling drugs, I'm out, don't contact me again. And it's not really explained here. There's not a good reminder of that, even though it's been probably 3,000 words of story space, you know, like 15 pages since that happened. And you can't always assume that your reader is going to be reading chapter after chapter. And so it might have been a week since your reader actually read that section and wouldn't remember what's going on, and that would exactly pull them out of the story. So that's why you need those little reminders, which I'm sure I've told you guys before. But what's interesting here about the text is Alex, like, do you think it has something to do with seeing that cop? Which is a reasonable thing for Alex to say. But then the odd thing here is that when Wiles says, I've been way too lenient with Connolly, and I can see that now. It's not going to happen anymore. So this is interesting, because what we know of Wiles is that he's a hothead, he's extremely violent. He beat the crap out of some dude at the baseball court way back in part two. He beat the crap, or he threatened to beat the crap out of that frat guy. Actually, he didn't touch him, I don't think.
for kissing Megan. Now he knows that Brian had sex with Megan, and all he says about it is, I've been way too lenient with him. We don't really get a sense of Wiles' menace. If you're just looking at the text without seeing it from inside Wiles' POV, all you really get is this kind of sense that Wiles isn't really taking this seriously and that he's blowing it off. Maybe it's not that big of a deal. So it's not helping to ramp up the tension, because what the reader should be thinking is, Brian is a goner. Brian's going to be killed. Wiles is going to freak out. And, you know, Brian, the end is coming. You know, it should be ramping up toward, there's only like 13 chapters left in this book. There's maybe, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 words left in the book. So the tension should really be ramping up, and we should be making our reader excited to get to the climax. All of the plot lines should be converging, and everything should be getting more exciting. But here it seems like we have a dip in the tension, because Wiles isn't all that excited about what Brian did. That's kind of strange. That definitely should have been fixed. That should have been something I considered. You know, like your move toward your climax should be a steeper and steeper curve as the book goes on. Definitely. Like, early on in the book, you can have tension peaks and valleys, but when you're in the home stretch, it's ramping up the tension till it reaches fever pitch, and you don't ever want to dip. That's not to say you can't still have scene and sequel, but the overall tension, that curve, goes up and up and up. So Alex has some interesting interior monologue here where he thinks that Brian is going to sell them out, and he's worried about if Wiles got in trouble. That's the most interesting thing here, actually, now that I think about it. So the thing is, here's the line. Actually says, maybe the cops picked him up for DUI and he had to give up Wiles as part of the deal. If that's the case, then I would be implicated. Would Wiles protect me, or would he roll over on me too? So here we see that Alex's loyalties are still a little divided. He's still not 100% committed to Wiles, because he doesn't know if Wiles got in legal trouble, if he would protect him or roll over on him. And that's kind of interesting, because that is a little bit of foreshadowing for later on. And then we have Wiles starting to put his plan into place, where he says, I've got an idea. I need you with me. I need you to trust me. This might get kind of messy. So Wiles has a plan. We don't know what the plan is, and it's not really discussed very much until later. We're going to see Wiles' plan in action about how he's going to deal with Brian, starting maybe in the next chapter, I'm not sure, but very soon. But so Alex doesn't really get a sense of what Wiles' plan is, because he's distracted by this dastardly cow. Dastardly is it's a great word, isn't it? I love that word. With the black eyes, the patchy brown hair, the mangy creature's persistent look. And I mentioned before, I really like this part, so I won't go into it again, but I love the italicized dialogue from the cow. Pull the trigger, human, you'll never hit me. And Alex calls him a cock smoker. And Wiles is upset because he doesn't have Alex's full attention. You know, he's demanding Alex's loyalty, and he's like, are you in? And Alex just pays him lip service to say, yeah, dude, whatever. And the idea here is Alex is committed to helping Wiles with whatever this plan is, even though he doesn't know what it is, because Alex is too distracted. And then he shoots his paintball gun. He hits the cow in the head, which causes the cow to fall over, which I have no idea if that's even realistic. We don't know how, I don't think I say in this chapter how far away from the cows they are, but hitting a cow from maybe 5 feet might kill it or give it a concussion, or I don't even know. But hitting a cow from 150 feet probably wouldn't do anything. Again, I never played paintball, so I don't know. But then, so we do end the chapter with a nice little sentence. The last thing in the world he wanted right now is to piss off Derek Wiles, which isn't a cliffhanger, but I still like the way this chapter ends. You know, he's saying that Alex, the subtext there is that Alex is more afraid of Wiles than he is loyal to Wiles. And so maybe that does help explain Alex's behavior, you know, why he didn't just run away and abandon Wiles, is that he's too scared of him. And it's a little bit of telling. It's not great showing, but it does help explain that a little bit. and helps drive us forward to the next chapter, which we will talk about next week. And what up, guys? Thanks for listening to me again. This is the end of the show, and I'll see you in 7 days. Okay, bye.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I know, but don't be sad, we will be back. Please, don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes and Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to have found it. I mean, wherever it was, they're obviously got good taste, so please rate and review it anyway. Also, we'd like you to check out our blog at indieauthoranswers.com. You can also, I mean, if you're up for it and you've got time, pop on over to jimheskett.com, and you can even sign up for the email list and you'll get free stuff. I mean, who doesn't like free stuff, right? Of course you do. So go on, you can do that as well. By the way, don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter at IndieAnswers, and you can like our Facebook page. And if you've still got time for that, then obviously you haven't got much time left for writing. And let's face it, that's what this is about in the end. So once you've done all that, why not go out there and write something? I mean, it's what Jim wants you to do. And if Jim wants you to do it, then you should really do it.